Our democracy is hanging by a thread, but we know it's not about just winning and losing each battle. It's about persistence and building resilience.
That's why we're launching the Practivist Pod, the practice of activism made practical.
If you're looking for ways to get engaged or just for ways to stay sane, we want to help you navigate what comes next.
It's an exciting collaboration with political dynamo Jess Craven, author of the Chop Wood, Carry Water newsletter.
And grassroots activist Steve Pearson, host of the How We Win podcast.
Every week on the Practivist Pod, we're going to have important conversations with changemakers, give you practical ways to make an impact, have some fun, and inspire hope.
This is more than a podcast. It's a place for our community to grow our practice of advocacy for justice, equity, and progress.
Action is the best antidote for anxiety. So subscribe to the Practivist Pod today.
Hello and welcome to Care Talk, where we talk about how healthcare works or doesn't work in America and answer your health insurance and healthcare questions. Please text or call in your questions at 202-838-6837 and be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And now it's my pleasure to welcome Margarita, the Executive Director of HCAN, Healthcare for America Now, to tell us what's going on in Congress this week and all about the budget. Welcome, Margarita.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So tell us, the House and the Senate are both working on budget bills, and the clock is ticking because there's a government shutdown in about a month if nothing happens. So enlighten us.
It's very messy. I'm going to try to simplify. So the House and the Senate are both working on several bills at once. And so I'll just mention a few different ones. We have the current government funding bill. That's what we call the continuing resolution, which essentially has kept funding at the same level for months and months and months. And the reason that is true is because Republicans and Democrats couldn't get to an agreement about how much to increase funding. So, you know, government funding, it's like anything else. It increases just like your household budget increases as things develop and change. People have different needs. We've got aging population. We've got kids. We've got natural disasters. So because the Republicans and the Democrats couldn't agree in the last Congress, we ended up with this continuing resolution. What the legislators have to do now is they have to agree to either pass a budget. So they actually have to agree to a budget, which is hard, or they have to agree to basically extend the budget on its current terms by March 14th. If that doesn't happen, then government funding will automatically run out, which means piece by piece, the federal government will shut down. All functions will shut down. So everything from security functions to Meals on Wheels and Head Start, all the things. Related to that is a process that's happening in parallel, which is the development of next year's budget, the 2025 budget. And that budget is going to happen through a special process called reconciliation, which is a fast track process. There's lots of disagreement among Republicans because at this point in this Congress, Republicans control both chambers. They control the Senate, they control the House. And so it's really a matter of Republicans coming together in the House and the Senate and coming to agreement on what they want to do. But that has not happened. Republicans in the House, they want one big bill, one giant bill that includes $4 trillion in tax breaks for wealthy people. And those tax breaks are paid for by $2 trillion in cuts for everybody else, essentially. And of course, the biggest of those cuts, what we talk about, Laura talks about all the time, are the massive cuts to healthcare. So you've got the one bill strategy that House Republicans are moving under Leader Jeffries' leadership. And then in the Senate, you have a whole different thing happening. So, you know, the Senate is also controlled by Republicans. Republicans in the Senate have a different strategy. They want a two-part system. The first bill is what they're calling a skinny reconciliation bill, which includes about $300 billion for border security, deportation, and a series of other things, security things that the president wants. And the Senate's theory is we want to move something quick with this funding to start moving on the border issues and deportation, more money to ICE, more money for the border wall. We want that like right now. So rather than working on trying to stop the shutdown of government by coming to agreement on the continuing resolution, they're trying to quickly shove through this other bill. In fact, it's going to the floor in the Senate on Thursday with the $300 billion in increases for defense and border security. And so that's creating a tremendous amount of pressure. Now, you might be thinking, yeah, they got a month on this government funding situation. Like, they, can't they come to an agreement in a month on the government shutdown thing? Generally, no. I would have to say the answer is probably no on that. And that is because there is a very, very slim margin in the House. There's a slim margin in the Senate, too, but it's very, very slim in the House. And everybody understands that Republicans will not be able to pass a continuing resolution to keep the government open without the support of Democrats. So they have to get Democrats to agree in order to be able to keep the government open past March 14th. And if they tried to add all the stuff that they have in their skinny bill, ICE, you know, money for more deportations, the border wall, all of these just gazillions of dollars for defense, Democrats are unlikely to support that bill. So they really have a dilemma here because they don't really have a working relationship with the Democrats, who they are going to need to pass bills, and they can't agree amongst themselves. That is, Republicans in the House and Republicans in the Senate are fighting amongst themselves and can't get to an agreement. Unfortunately, if there is a government shutdown, it will be a worse situation than what we're seeing right now with all of the freezes that are coming as a result of executive orders. And it's going to be real people that actually face the consequences of a failure of government to stay open.
So,
yeah, unravel that knot.
Right. So the most important deadline to keep in mind is the March 14th deadline, where they have to either have a budget or agree on an extension so they can keep working on a budget, right?
That's
so
right.
If there's no agreement by March 14th, the government shuts down, right?
Government shuts down, yep.
So is there any kind of deadline for both the Senate and the House are working on budget bills and they're not in agreement and the whole process could take a while? So is there any kind of deadline for them, or is it all kind of operating under the March 14th? Something needs to be done by March 14th.
There's no deadline. The current government funding bill, that which is a continuing resolution, has to be done by March 14th. The other budget resolutions that they're working on, they can work on multiple annual budgets at the same time. So the budget that we're operating on right now that we're calling the CR is the 2024 budget. They also have a plan for the 2025 budget, and they also are probably going to use the 2026 budget to move a part of their agenda. And this really is all about advancing the president's priorities, right? The president laid out a set of priorities that include huge tax breaks to wealthy people, extension of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, the tariff stuff, the border control, deportation stuff. And so the Republicans can use any of those three vehicles to advance his agenda. They can do it in one bill, they can do it in two bills. The process doesn't really matter. What really matters is the priority, right? That the priority is really going to be taking away healthcare, taking away services, cutting Medicaid, taking away those enhanced subsidies on the Affordable Care Act, which will make it much harder for people to afford their insurance. They can do whatever process they want. The only deadline they have to adhere right now, there's actually only two. There's March 14th, which is the continuing resolution that they have to get to agreement on, or the government will shut down and there will be political consequences. And then the second deadline they have to think about is the debt ceiling. So at some point, the United States, as we do like annually, is going to hit the point at which it can no longer cover all of its fiscal responsibilities. And so they're going to have to raise the debt ceiling. Now, the president was trying to avoid that situation. You might remember last year he was talking about just abolishing the debt ceiling, which, you know, he wasn't able to do. So they're going to have to do something about the debt ceiling by whatever date. And usually we know that date is going to be in March or April. And that as we get closer, they will actually, the Fed will actually say it's this date. So they have to deal with those two deadlines. On the debt ceiling, they have to lift the debt ceiling to avoid defaulting on their debt, right? So, but aside from that, Republicans can take as long as they want. And we've seen in the past, the reason that they really use the budget bills is because the budget bill is the only kind of bill that works in this reconciliation process. And they want to use the reconciliation process because the reconciliation process allows them to pass a bill with just a majority, not a two-thirds threshold. So most bills in the Senate, you have to get 60 votes. With a reconciliation bill, which is a budget bill, you only have to get 50 plus one. So that's why everybody up here is talking about budget bills, budget bills, budget bills. It's because budget bills can be done through the reconciliation process. And budget bills, there's a fair amount of flexibility on what you can put in them. Those are going to be the main vehicles that they're going to use to move the president's agenda. And aside from the continuing resolution, which is the 2024 bill, there's really nothing in terms of deadlines. And we've seen in the past that it's dragged on and on and on, though I think Speaker Johnson in the House has said repeatedly that he thinks this whole thing will be done by April. Seems far-fetched. It seems fanciful given the level of disagreement in his caucus, but I guess it's good to be optimistic, but I don't think so.
So there's the skinny Senate bill, and then there's the big House bill. They both cut healthcare, Medicaid in particular, right? And can you tell us more about what those cuts look like?
The skinny bill doesn't cut healthcare yet because there will be a part two. So there's, this is a little bit processy, but there's some Republicans that say, let's have two bills. Let's have one that's smaller, the skinny bill, that's just got all the stuff that Trump wants to do immediately that will give him some quick wins. So, you know, that's spending on, you know, the border. It's got the tariff, some of those things. The big bill, this will be their second one in this two-part saga. And the second one is going to have the tax breaks, right? So the extension of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And that one will have big, big Medicaid cuts. How do we know that? Because when you're talking about spending trillions of dollars on tax breaks for the wealthy, there's not that many programs that are big enough where you can extract trillions of dollars, right? Medicaid is, you could extract trillions of dollars out of Medicaid if you wanted to demolish that program, because keep in mind that is healthcare for 80 million people. So the Senate has this kind of two-part strategy, two bills, a skinny bill and then the big bill, kind of like an appetizer in the main course. The House has said, nope, we want one big bill, or as Trump has said, one big, beautiful bill. And they've got a huge bill, and their bill is $4 trillion in tax breaks for the wealthy, and at least $2 trillion, $2.3 trillion in cuts. A lot of those cuts, over half, come from healthcare. But there's other cuts in there, too. There's cuts to lots of domestic programs. There's cuts to nutrition, almost a complete annihilation of the SNAP program, which is, again, a health adjacent program, really important. Lots of cuts to housing, lots of cuts to job training, lots of cuts to education. So essentially what they've done is they've gone through and they've cut as much as they can. And keep in mind that the current budget that we're operating under, the CR, that we're also has cuts. So this would be much deeper cuts, much longer term cuts. With respect to healthcare, what's dangerous isn't just that it's a cut. What they are talking about is making some fundamental changes to the program so that, those cuts would be, in essence, permanent cuts, right? Essentially, the federal government would just stop providing federal funding to states at the level that we are used to for Medicaid services. So that's everything from substance abuse to in-home and institutional care for seniors, healthcare for kids, almost half of all kids are on Medicaid, healthcare for people with disabilities. it really would change healthcare as we know it right now in the United States. So it's not just that it would extract money, it would fundamentally change the structure of the program to really disrupt healthcare in state after state after state.
What can or should people be doing if they are upset about these possible cuts to healthcare?
Here's the number one thing that I think is important for people to do. I think it's really important for people to call Republicans. If you live in a state that has, and you're in a district that is represented by a Republican, or you have a Republican senator, or you have a Republican governor, very important, right? Because these cuts are going to shift huge burdens to states. And in every state, Medicare is called something different. I mean, Medicaid is called something different. Here in Massachusetts, it's called MassHealth. Next door in Connecticut, it's Husky Care. So it's really important to call your governor if your governor is a Republican and say, these are devastating cuts, and this is going to affect my kid, my grandma, my brother who has a disability, my son who was an addict. You know, I just think it's really, really important. And we're all used to calling Democrats because Democrats have been allies on healthcare in the past, and we should do that too. But make no mistake here, Republicans are in control, they're in the majority. And what we really have to do is alert Republicans that we are extremely aware of what they are doing, and that we understand that they are putting the priorities of wealthy people, right? Because this whole thing is about making cuts so that they can pay for $4 trillion in tax breaks to rich people and corporations. We just have to let them know that we know that, because that will change how Republicans behave. Remember, they're used to really behaving with very little accountability. So even if you don't live in a Republican district, maybe you don't have a Republican senator, maybe you don't have a Republican governor, in most states, there's at least one Republican in Congress or in the Senate. So you should find somebody in that district and have them call their member. And then, of course, in the meantime, call Democrats and urge Democrats to fight, and urge them to fight on the healthcare issues, right? Like, Democrats are acting like they can't figure out what is important to people in America. Well, we know what's important to people in America: being able to take your kid to the doctor when he's sick, being able to get treatment for an injury, being able to get cancer care. Laura will talk about that. I'm a cancer survivor. Like, these things are important, and we know they are important to people across the board. And we know that the cost of private health care is going up, 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 and people are feeling it as an essential economic issue. It's a kitchen table issue. So number one thing, contact your lawmakers. Do not let them hang out in DC just doing whatever the hell they want to do, acting like they are not going to be accountable to their constituents.
Thank you, Margarita. Thanks for joining us and enlightening us on what's going on in Congress. And I'm sure we'll have you back as this continues, because there isn't going to be a solution soon.
No, you're right about that. We will have lots of opportunities to talk about it. Thanks for the opportunity. I'll come back anytime, and happy to answer people's questions. People can get in touch with us on our website, healthcareforamericanow.com.
Thank you, Margarita.
Thank you.
And now I'd like to introduce Louise Norris of healthinsurance.org to answer our first viewer question for today. And this person, this came in via text. This person says, I received a very large medical bill for the hospital, but I'm not sure if I qualify for help. So, Louise, do you have any thoughts for what somebody should do if they get a large medical bill that they're having problems paying?
Definitely. So this depends a lot on what the situation is. Whether you are insured or uninsured is sort of the big first part of it. If you are uninsured, there are a couple options. You may qualify for retroactive Medicaid. This will depend on your income, whether you'd be eligible for Medicaid. In most states, Medicaid can be retroactive up to 90 days. So if you qualified for Medicaid in the past and hadn't enrolled, in most states, you can fill out the paperwork and get retroactive coverage. That could be an option. If you don't qualify for Medicaid, or if your state doesn't offer retroactive Medicaid eligibility, you can work directly with the hospital to see if you qualify for a charity care program. Or you might find that your state has a program for this, like Colorado is an example. If your income is under 250% of the poverty level, you qualify for a reduced hospital payment program. Other states, there are different programs in different states, but you'd need to contact your state insurance department or talk directly with the hospital. If you are insured, there are rules that prohibit health and healthcare providers from waiving your deductible or your other cost sharing, because that would be a violation of their contract with your health plan. So the only way they can do that is with very specific guidelines on hardship waivers. They have to apply those the same for everybody. They have to have a, you know, protocols that they go through. So you would again need to reach out to the hospital, to their billing department, to see if you can qualify for a hardship waiver, or if not, just what their program is for making payments, so that you can have a reasonable payment amount to pay it off over time. $4.org, $4.org is a good resource that you can use, where you can, it'll ask you where you live and what hospital you were at, and it'll show you eligibility for assistance programs, repayment programs, stuff like that.
In Virginia, pay attention to a bill in the state legislature right now that would do a lot of changes to the way that medical debt works in Virginia, including capping interest rates and late fees, and banning hospitals from wage garnishment if you qualify for payment assistance, as well as preventing hospitals from coming after your home and major assets for medical debt. So if you're in Virginia, pay attention. If you're in any state, pay attention to what state rules apply. And if there aren't good state protections, that's something you could talk to your state legislators about making changes on. And our next question is from Sarah on Facebook, who wanted to know, do insurers offering Medicare supplemental policies, sometimes called Medigap, have the right to deny an application based on pre-existing conditions? And to talk about that, welcome Diane Archer from Just Care and Social Security Works.
Thanks, Laura. So this is a really important question, because anybody who is in Medicare Advantage right now should be thinking about their right to switch Medicare Advantage policies or to switch into traditional Medicare. But if you're switching into traditional Medicare, you always need supplemental coverage if you want to protect yourself against high financial costs, because traditional Medicare doesn't have an out-of-pocket cap. So your rights become really important to getting that coverage. If you are under 65, unfortunately, under federal law, you have no guaranteed right to this supplemental protection in traditional Medicare. If you're over 65 and going on Medicare for the first time, or going from being disabled and turning 65 and going on Medicare, you do have a guaranteed right in every state, regardless of your health, to Medicare supplemental coverage. And that right lasts for 6 months from the time that you first enroll in Medicare. However, you also have a guaranteed right if you decide that you're going to enroll first in Medicare Advantage and you're only in Medicare Advantage plan for less than a year when you decide you'd rather be in traditional Medicare. Then you also can buy that supplemental coverage. And here, let me just stop for a second and explain those differences, because this gets so crazy complicated. But basically, traditional Medicare gives you access to doctors and hospitals across the country for your care. Almost all doctors and hospitals take you, and Medicare will cover. And in addition, you don't have to go through prior authorization in order to get approval before you get the services that your treating physician and you believe you need. In Medicare Advantage, what you're getting is a network of doctors who you can see if you want coverage. And you may need prior authorization if you end up getting sick for any costly services that you're needing. As a result, lots of folks go into Medicare Advantage, can be happy for a time, and then when they get sick, find that they can't see the doctors they need to see, or they can't get the care that they believe they need in Medicare Advantage and they want to go into traditional Medicare. So if you're every year you have the right to switch into traditional Medicare, right now you have the right to do so. But then the question becomes, okay, if I don't have a guaranteed right, because it's not the first time for me to be in Medicare, and I've been in Medicare for more than a year, every state is different. And you need to look also into your state policies and also federal exceptions that do require insurers to guarantee you your Medigap coverage, even if you have a pre-existing condition. So I'll stop here in order not to get too technical, but to say that if you live in Massachusetts, New York, Connecticut, or Maine, you always have a guaranteed right to buy supplemental coverage. There are rules about when and which and how and all of that. So contact your state health insurance assistance program or Medicare Rights Center. I know that number by heart since I started the organization, 800-333-4114, 800-333-4114. And you can find out the nitty gritty details. And maybe you'll get lucky and there will be a plan in your state, a Medigap plan that you can buy.
So this is definitely something to consider before you go for Medicare Advantage for the first time, because you may or may not be able to get a Medigap plan if you want to switch back later.
Exactly right. And you can still switch back to traditional Medicare, but your out-of-pocket costs will be unlimited. It will be the 20%. It will be limited to 20% of your doctor's charges, but that can be a lot of money.
Right. So thank you for that. We will answer more specific questions as more specific questions come in. Our next question comment is from Morgan on Twitter, who said that my insurance, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, just informed me that my cancer follow-up MRI to check for spread is deemed not a medical necessity and therefore not authorized. Louise, what can Morgan or anybody in this situation do about this?
So this is a perfect example of making sure people know about their right to appeal. On most health insurance policies in the United States, the Affordable Care Act gives you the right to appeal. And it's both an internal appeal, where you go directly through the insurance company. You and your doctor work together to appeal the insurance plan's decision. If that fails, you also have the right to an external appeal, which is where an independent third party is getting involved and taking a look at all the notes from your doctor, what your health plan has decided, and then making a decision. The vast majority of health plan denials do not get appealed. Oftentimes it's because people don't know what their appeal rights are. So my advice here in this situation is appeal. You do not have to do it on your own. Your doctor, in this case, speak with your oncologist. They can, if they are in network with your health plan, they will probably submit the appeal paperwork for you. And then you can follow up, but definitely make sure you're appealing. Most people don't, and that's a problem.
And in this case, it sounds like more of a checkup, but in general, if you need your medical care in a timely manner because you're going through something, how long do these appeal processes normally take? What if you have an urgent need?
So there are different state rules on this. It really depends on where you live. And there's also different classifications for what they consider urgent versus what they don't. Sometimes it's just a few days. For less urgent matters, health plans can take, longer, to a week or 2 weeks or even more. This will definitely depend on your state. And you can contact your state Department of Insurance to ask them what are their rules in terms of how long your health plan has before they need to get back to you with a decision on an appeal.
And as Diane has pointed out in the past, also, if you are not getting good service from your insurance company, you can also try going public. You can try contacting your senators and or your representative and or sharing your story on social media, talking to a reporter. And sometimes that will get things moving faster for you than the official process, which you can and should still do. but if you need timely help, consider escalating.
Absolutely.
And with that, thank you everybody for joining us for Care Talk today. Please text or call in your questions at 202-838-6837 for future episodes. Join us next week for more, and be sure to subscribe to my channel or podcast wherever you get your podcasts. This is Care Talk.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.